Hello, this is Sam. Before starting this week's show, I just wanted to point out that we recorded this on Wednesday evening U.S. time, and due to a variety of life getting in the way kind of things, I'm not releasing it until Saturday morning U.S. time. And in the meantime, there's been a lot of news, specifically the terrorist attacks in Paris. So obviously, we do not talk about that on the show you are about to hear, because it hadn't happened yet. We will talk about that next week on the show, I am sure. But in the meantime, enjoy today's show. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, November 12th, 2015. It's just after 2 UTC as we're starting to record this today. And guess what? It's another week where Yvonne can't make it. Sent me an email earlier this week saying, hey, I'm traveling again. I didn't think I would be. I'm going to be busy. I won't be able to make it. Blah, 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 blah. So I have this break that gets inserted every once in a while that says, hey, if you're a listener and you're interested in the show and you want to co-host sometimes, send me a note. And I sent out an email to all the people who've previously co-hosted, plus one person who has not, but who has expressed interest in it. And so today we have a brand new co-host we haven't heard from before. So hello, Amber.
Hello.
And so I told Amber I would just have her introduce herself a little bit. The first time I spoke to Amber directly, as opposed to email or other things, was just a few minutes before we started recording. So Amber, introduce yourself.
Well, thank you. Hi, and hello, everyone. So this is kind of fresh and off the cuff, but I know you actually longer than maybe you even know it, because you had a guest, Dr. Hunter, on a couple months ago, and we went to grad school together. And I have actually been hearing your opinions about things like debates and elections and things like that over the years for a long time. And you're pretty much the registered expert.
Oh, so you know, if I'm considered an expert on anything, you're probably already lost.
Well, maybe. Well, we'll see. So I'm happy to be on the show, and I'm glad that you're taking me on here really on the fly, and I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. Do you want to give just a few seconds on your background, who you are, et cetera, other than, you know, my good friend, Chad?
Right. Yeah, sure. So let's see. I live in Virginia, even though I'm actually from Massachusetts. So I've got a little bit of north and south in me. I think I consider myself a Yankee, but I have lived in Virginia for a long time now. My background is more technically based in physics, and I work as kind of a tech person for the government, but I'm also a musician, and I love that side, and so there's always the mix between left and right brain stuff going on there. And so I love your show because you talk about every kind of thing under the sun. I never know what you're going to talk about. And I like that because they're all interesting. And I have two sons, and that's about all there is to me.
There you go. Well, welcome to the show. And speaking of doing things a little bit different on the show, as we sometimes do when we have co-hosts, we're going to depart a little bit from sort of the standard routine topics that Yvonne and I talk about week in and week out. So, for instance, although we may get to it a little bit in the lightning round, election 2016 is not on the agenda for today's show. We're not going to talk about tech things or the new iPad Pro that came out this week or anything like that. No. So that I let Amber choose the topics. And so we're going to talk about a few things. Number one is
the experience of driver's licenses and how you get them and how that varies state to state and place by place and how it maybe differs now versus how it was, decades ago when I was a kid. That's topic one. Then we're going to talk about the coverage of science on TV and maybe broaden that out to the mass media in general, but how science gets covered. And then the third big topic, which is a little bit related, but when you hear all of these things, specifically health recommendations, and I think a lot of these are nutritional, but not always, you know, like there were reports out just a few weeks ago about how, you know, bacon causes cancer and red meat is bad for you and this and that. And in the past, there have been comments about sugars or fat or whatever. And it seems like the advice is always changing. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. And, you know, when do you actually sort of take these recommendations seriously? Or when do you say, you know, that's what they say this week. Let me wait a few years and see what they say then, you know. And then we'll follow all that up with a lightning round and, whatever comes up for each of us in the lightning round. So we may hit a few of my normal topics in the lightning round, but we'll leave it there for now. That's the agenda. I did want to give one quick update before we move on to the main show. And I'd mentioned a few weeks ago that I broke my foot and I'm on crutches for 6 weeks and a nice little boot and fun stuff like that. I wanted to mention that this week, for the first time since my injury, I actually went into the office in person for a couple days instead of working from home. Yeah, I know. I'd feel much better than I did 2 weeks ago. It's been like 2.5 weeks since when I broke my foot. Much, much better. I've moved from the first few days being in a big, huge, immobilizing boot and a couple crutches to being on two crutches and a much lighter boot to one crutch and a boot. And now sort of going around inside the house, I'm sort of hopping around even without the crutch because I'm allowed to put weight on my left heel, just not the rest of my foot. But I'm still using the crutch when I am going any further than just from room to room in my house.
Sometimes you don't realize what you have until it's gone, huh?
Yeah. But it was a little adventure going into work, especially one of the 2 days, Tuesday, we had one of these company all hands meetings, and my company is huge enough that they hold these in a big arena kind of place that holds tens of thousands of people, so I was trying to get there, and I had to sort of hobble the block there and then manage the stairs up into the nosebleed seats because I was a little bit late, and that was fun. Basically I'm at the point where I can get around, but it's still very tiring. So once I go somewhere, I'm like, okay, I'm done for like 5 or 10 minutes while I recover from the fact that I just walked across the room or whatever. Not quite that bad, but anyway, I'm still taking advantage of this. I'm supposed to walk as little as possible and put as little weight on it as I can. So I'm still mostly working from home, but I'll go in occasionally when there's something that makes sense for it. This week there wasn't anything I really needed to be there for. I just wanted to show my face again. Anyway, I just wanted to give an update. Going through my wonderful 6 week healing process, although officially it's not till December 18th do I have them look at me again and do another x-ray to tell me if I can be done with all this stuff or whether I need to do it longer. So fun stuff.
Does it make you wonder whether you're doing everything with the right balance from home and work normally?
This is one of those things that occasionally annoys me. I would say with my particular job, and obviously this isn't true of everybody, but my particular job, I feel like I could probably do 90 to 95% of what I need to do from home with conference calls and such. There are very few times where I, quote unquote, need to be in the office in order to do what I need to do on a day-to-day basis. However, I recognize even so, you sort of lose out on the serendipity of hallway conversations.
And
not just the water cooler, but also I've found that there's this extra barrier that's there where people, you know, may have absolutely no compulsion about sort of walking over a couple feet and saying, "Hey, Sam, what about this issue?" But if they actually have to pick up the phone and call you or send an email or even do an IM, there's a little bit of additional resistance.
Yeah.
And so I've sometimes gotten frustrated when I've done a lot of working from home. It has not happened so far this time around. But I've sometimes gotten frustrated when it seems like certain things are happening at the office that I should be involved in, that I just sort of get the, "Oh, we decided whatever," that if I'd been there, I clearly would have inserted myself. And so you sometimes get that sort of thing. But still, I'd say, you know, if you really wanted to like optimize for efficiency, my particular job, I would work from home normally and only come in when there was a specific reason for it. That would optimize, certainly, you know, I mean, I'd save a ton of gas going back and forth. I've got a 50-mile-a-day commute when I go in.
Wow.
And a lot of, it would save me a lot of time because that translates into at least 2 hours on a normal day. I can minimize it a little bit if I avoid rush hour times. But, you know, on an average day, if I go in and come back, there's, you know, probably 2 to 2.5 hours in the car. Or, yeah,
a lot of commute time.
Maybe I can be a little more generous. 1.5 to 2.5 hours, depending on traffic and exactly when and where I come and go. And I also feel like, frankly, most of the time I end up being more efficient and get more done when I'm at home than I am at the office. And I don't know exactly why that is, whether it's not so much, you know, randomization and interruptions, but this something about the environment that makes me able to sort of get in a zone and work consistently better at home than I do at work.
Well, you have your own coffee machine and all your supplies and your own restroom and everything. But I mean, do you have anyone else around you at home, or is it just you?
Well, that really depends on the day, and that actually does make a big difference. Like if it's if I'm working from home because my son is sick and home from school, I'm not going to be as efficient as I would be otherwise because he's going to be wanting attention and things like that. If, however, you know, he's at school or his sister's taking care of him, like actually today was there was no school today because of Memorial Day, but his sister was home as well. And so they spent most of the day together and left me alone. But yeah, most of the time when I'm working from home, I'm the only one in the house.
I think that can be a mixed blessing because on the one hand, you have all your stuff around you and your environment and known quantities and whatnot. But I was trying to explain to my older son the other day, who's in 10th grade. He was saying he doesn't understand, you know, why he can't just wear whatever clothes he wants to wear to school and why he's going to have to wear different clothes when he goes to a job someday and everything. And some people wear a suit when they're going to have a track meet and things like that. And I thought about it a little bit while I was trying to drive through the traffic. And I thought, you know, I also hated the idea when I got out of school and it was time to actually have a real job. You know, I thought, you know, I don't want to wear a power suit or, you know, blazers or things like that. But then it occurred to me that if I didn't get out of my sweatpants in the morning or actually do something different to my routine that would
that would sort of psychologically indicate you're now doing something.
Like, I'm actually at work and I have to pay attention to it. It was kind of hard to get into that zone. So maybe if I was in the zone, then I'd be really in the zone, but it was hard to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. And I've done it both ways at home. When I'm working from home, sometimes I go through the whole morning routine. I take the shower, I change my clothes, I do blah, 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 and blah, blah. And then I'm like, okay, now I'm working. But sometimes I just roll out of bed and go straight to my desk and am doing stuff. Typically, you know, that depends, like, if, you know, do I have a, like, if I have an 8 a.m. conference call that I have to be on, chances are I'm rolling out of bed at 7:45, going straight to my desk and calling them without any preparation. On the other hand, if I if I just have to sit there answering email and stuff and there's no hard start time, then I will take the time and I will do my morning routine and then I will sit down and then I will start. If I can start a little bit later than those early meetings. And,
well, which one is better, do you think?
I like having that morning routine for a lot of reasons. It sort of gives you the time to sort of warm up your brain instead of, like, you know, snap your fingers and there you go. But on the, you know,
I don't think too many of us make our best decisions 15 minutes after getting out of bed.
Well, you know, it's usually not too bad, but yeah, it's, I think to me, the biggest factor is when do I have to start, you know, because, I am not a morning person at all. So if I have a somewhat flexible work from home schedule, then I will start a little bit later and I will work a little bit later. But I will, you know, sort of take my time getting up, when I start. But if I've got a hard start time because I've got a meeting, if it's an early meeting anyway, I'm likely to try to sleep as long as I possibly can before jumping into that meeting.
So what we're missing now with all that stuff is, I don't know if you guys have cubicle situations, but we call it prairie dog syndrome. And that's, you know, the person popping up over the cubicle saying, oh, I heard what you were just talking about.
Yes.
I have an idea about that. And yada, yada. The things that the connections you'd never think you were going to make.
That is definitely the trade-off you've got there. You lose a lot of the personal connection. You lose a lot of the sort of random connections you have there. But it is a significant trade-off. I mean, that is the clear benefit of all being in the same physical space. And the same applies also when people are working across different offices or even different continents. You have a lot of additional communication difficulties, and you have some of that simply by working from home, even if you're in the same time zone. But there are positives to working from home too. So it's,
absolutely.
I understand the mix, and I understand why it's useful, me not to actually be working from home 100% of the time, as much as I would like it. But you do have interesting trade-offs here. And one of the things is with modern technology available for video conferences, conference calls, email, online chats, lots of companies are now using Slack, which is sort of the next generation of, online office chat. There's less and less reason to have the physical office and all of the overhead that's associated with it.
Well, and that's a serious consideration. I mean, there's a lot of cost to going face to face. And if people are trying to be efficient and, you know, save money, save time, introduce diversity, flexibility, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for doing that. So, you know, I definitely think that the things that are uncomfortable for people about not being in person will get better over time. You know, just probably eventually a nice balance between being in person and working from home could be strong.
No, I think so. And it, obviously, it's also very, very different depending on what the job is.
Yeah.
You know, some jobs are more amenable to remote work than others.
Although, you know, here we are, people are being operated on remotely.
True.
So maybe we were not being open-minded enough, considering we're willing to get somebody operating on us from another country.
Anyway, I don't wish breaking. I don't wish for breaking my foot. I don't want to do it again. But I actually welcome the opportunity to do a little bit more work from home for a number of weeks. It's more relaxing. I actually think I'm getting more done most days. I mean, it varies day by day, but that's the true at the office too, you know, but I think I'm getting more done and you know, it's, I like it. But you know, hey, when the time comes, I'll be, back in the slog at the office. But, definitely one of the things that, you know, annoys me the most about, my current situation is the fact that my work and my home are so far apart from each other. I mean, it's only 25 miles, but the traffic is awful if you go at rush hour. And so the commute, not having the commute by itself, you know, sort of lifts like a huge weight. And it's like, well, this is nice, you know?
Wow.
So anyway.
That is a huge commute. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, some people have worse. But anyway, I think that's enough for this intro segment. So let's take a break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about driver's licenses.
Ready for the test, Dracula? I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we are back. Okay, Amber, so you suggested driver's licenses as a topic, and I admit, when you brought this up, I'm like, where's this coming from? Is there something topical about driver's licenses going on right now? And you mentioned a couple things, but you know, it's your topic. Drive this. What's interesting about driver's licenses right now?
All right, if I have a license to drive, I will drive this topic. yeah, well, you know, I hadn't really thought about it that much until, well, now I have two teenage sons, and the older one just got a learner's permit, which is, you know, really scary. So, you know, I do recommend that anybody in the Virginia area just stay off the roads for the next year.
Yeah, I remember going through that. My daughter just turned 20, but so about, you know, 4.5 years ago, we were going through that process with her. So,
oh gosh, it's scary.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we're talking about somebody who, you know, has gotten out of the shower before without turning off the shower. So I'm just wondering how this is going to go. But, you know, it took him the first time, and he actually didn't pass the written test. And I was asking him, you know, so what kind of things tripped you up? And he was telling me the kind of questions that were on there. There was a sort of a road sign test and then a sort of regular driving test. And he said one of the questions was really hard. It was an etiquette question.
Okay.
And it was, you know, what if somebody, if you're in a parking lot and you hit somebody's car, but they're not in the car.
Yes.
Should you know, A, B, C, or D? And one of the answers was stay there until the person comes back to the car. And the correct answer was put a note on the car with your information and then leave.
Okay.
And he said, well, gosh, you know, that seems funny because I would have thought maybe I should stay there. And, you know, so that sort of started some thinking about, gosh, the world has changed because maybe a couple decades ago, it would have been the best thing to just stay there. But you have no idea how long somebody's going to be, and you have no idea what they're going to be like when they get back and see that you hit their car.
Right. Well, on the flip side, if you leave a note, the note could be gone. Somebody else could take the note. It could rain and wash out your note. This has happened to me. Accidentally dinging somebody's door or something. We've left a note. And that does seem to be the normal etiquette kind of thing to do. But it also, seems wrong to me to count it wrong for stay there.
Because wrong to me, too.
Yeah, because, if anything, the reason not to stay there is because it's potentially inconvenient to you. But it seems like it's actually better, if you actually do get to see the person, exchange your insurance information, all that kind of stuff. So I could see why leave a note is the normal thing to do. And I guess it's right in that sense, but it's not like staying there would be wrong. The only wrong answer is hit and run and leave without doing anything.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know why you should fail your test for guessing wrong on that one. I mean, I actually have been in a situation before where I had left my bike somewhere. It wasn't a car, but I'd left my bike somewhere and it was locked and everything. And I went shopping and I came back and there was this guy standing with my bike. And I was thinking, what in the world? And he had stood there for an hour and a half while I was gone because somebody had cut the lock off my bike and he, shooed him off and didn't want to just leave my bike there. And, that's kind of affected me forever since then. So, it had a great impact and I thought, gosh, what a nice thing to do. And he doesn't know anything about me. And this whole thing with the driver's license made me think about how much, we've changed in terms of who knows what kind of road rage would be going on with whoever's coming back and sees their car dinged. But that wasn't the only thing. Then I was also thinking, Virginia has just changed their laws.
Before you move on to that, I just wanted to finish up on the note thing. There are two more things I wanted to mention on that. One is there's another advantage that sometimes occurs with the note. This may not be common, but I just want to point out because my wife did this. Somebody else dinged her car. It was actually a little bit more than a ding. But there was damage to the side of her car because they opened their door into it or something. Who knows? It was in a parking lot during a concert, whatever. They did indeed leave a note. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. They left a really nice little note that said, I'm really sorry. I banged your car. Here's my phone number. I'll pay for the damages, blah, blah, blah. And we brought my wife brought the note home. We stuck it on the refrigerator and my wife was so self-conscious about it. She never called them.
Oh, really?
for weeks and weeks, I was saying, Brandy, call them. And she got an estimate to have whatever it was fixed. And you know how body stuff is on a car. It's way more expensive than you would ever think it is for something small. So it was $300 or whatever to fix whatever this was. And I'm like, call them. And she's like, no, I feel bad. I don't know. And then it became, well, but it's been 3 months. And then it was well, it's been 6 months. Well, it's been a year.
And the note, ball in her court.
Yeah, and the note is still sitting on our refrigerator. It's been a year and a half. Meanwhile, she delayed and delayed on actually getting it fixed too. Eventually, she got it fixed. We paid for it ourselves. We paid for it ourselves. It took another accident happening that also damaged the same part of the car. Insurance did cover that. But she made sure she's like, no, that one part was already damaged. I got that. And of course, she's also being honest there. She could have easily claimed that happened in the second accident, but she didn't. She still paid for it. It was a taillight that was broken.
This is about more than etiquette. It's about your whole, you know, personality and character.
Yeah, I mean, it was all just a matter of she felt self-conscious calling this person out of the blue to take her up on the offer to pay for the damages. So, whatever.
That's complicated.
And then the other thing your question reminded me of, you mentioned that was the question on the test about leaving the note. What I remember from my very first driver's license were questions that were like, how far before a stop sign should you start slowing down? 100 feet, 200 feet, or 300 feet?
and you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, how am I supposed to pick one of these?
Yeah, and it's like, it's this numeric thing where it's like, you know, look, in real life, you're judging based on all the situations around you. You're seeing what's, you know, it depends on how fast you were going when you started, but you know,
you're not thinking, okay, let me calculate here. It's supposed to be 100 feet because I'm at this point. Yeah. It's not an actual calculation in your mind. It's right. Just an intuitive thing.
And meanwhile, so the only way to get these particular answers was not to use sort of any common sense that you'd gathered from watching people drive from age 0 to 15. No, you had to read the little booklet they gave you and memorize the correct answer. And I
remember, which you never do again in a car ever.
Right. And I remember that really annoying me. One, because I suck at memorization. Like my whole thing all through school, all through everything, is anything that was based purely on memorization, I would do badly at. I had to figure out why it was the way it was. And if I could figure out why so that it made sense to me, then, well, of course, that's the answer, because that has to be the answer because it makes sense. But if the answer was only the answer because that's what it was, because somebody decided it, or because it was a fact that you had to memorize, you know, such and such happened in whatever year, forget it. And so I was annoyed that there were memorization questions on here instead of things that sort of just made sense. And also, like you said, that's not how people drive. You know, it makes perfect sense to, you know, show people an outline of a stop sign and say, what do you do when you see this sign? Okay.
Right.
You kind of need to memorize that, you know, a red octagon means stop. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, you don't have to memorize that an octagon has 8 sides, for instance.
True.
You know, like there's the fact that is useful for driving versus just knowing what you need to drive. And considering we have, you know, all this modern technology and everything, I don't see why somebody has to answer a multiple choice question about how many yards. And actually, that was a big problem before my son took his test. You know, I was saying, oh, you know, are you sure you're ready for this test? You know, I don't want to waste my time at the DMV for hours and hours. And I just asked him, he said, oh, I'm sure. And I asked him a random question, you know, just trying to think of anything. But similarly, I couldn't even figure out what to ask him because no one thinks of this stuff anymore. Like, how many yards is it, whatever? And I said, well, how far away do you have to be to park, you know, from a fire hydrant? I said, oh, I know this one. 250 yards. And I'm thinking,
no.
More than 2 football fields? That's a tough parking situation, you know. So but to me, that just shows how pointless multiple choice and exact yardage questions are. Because it wasn't, if he had a moment to think about how that didn't make any sense.
You know? Well, and even there, it's like, how many situations do you actually have to think, am I far enough away from this? Because guess what? They're signs, or they've painted the curb, or there's some sort of visual indicator, you know, that says, don't park here.
Yeah. And you know what? The worst thing that could happen is they go through your windows and do it that way. Like, it's just,
they can give you a ticket for too. They can give you a ticket.
or just shove your car out of the way. And there are multiple solutions to that problem, whereas the fact that we drive at 70 miles per hour 1 foot away from people we've never met before and will never know, you know, that seems more important to me.
Yeah, and it's all based on trust, because at any moment, like if you think of a typical highway situation, all it takes is one guy deciding that, you know, he wants to, and, you know, swerve the wheel into the oncoming traffic, and you have a major accident and lots of people dead.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. And, you know, we talk about all sorts of different things that are fearful for us, terrorism and whatnot, not that it's not all important, but car accidents happen by the thousands all the time, you know? And so it does seem just sort of silly, some of the kind of questions they ask. And the other reason that came up in my mind is because I got my first driver's license in New Jersey growing up, and the written test was 90 minutes long.
Wow.
And the driving test was actually easy. And then in senior year, moved to Massachusetts, and the driving test in the greater Boston area is basically you have to be able to jump over a car, plow through snow, and hit somebody and use the proper finger while you're getting away. You know, the driving test is crazy, but the written test was 10 questions. And I'm not kidding about this. One of the questions, this is, you know, memorable. One of the questions was, the primary function of seatbelt is A, no function at all. B, to keep your groceries warm. C, to keep you from flying out of the car in case of an accident. And D, I think B was to keep you warm, and D was to keep your groceries down. That's what it was.
It's got to be the groceries.
Keep you warm or keep your groceries down. Yeah, so I guess my argument would be, if you get that question wrong at all, no matter how you do on the rest of the test, you shouldn't be driving. Or maybe even, you know, around.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's the written part of driving tests seems somewhat nuts to me in general. Like, especially if you're going to have the practical test, if you're going to put people behind the wheel and watch what they do, it seems like that should trump everything. That's when you're really observing. And those tests should be realistic and go through all the things you have to go through, as opposed to, you know, some very stilted set of things in a parking lot, maybe. Like, maybe you have to actually leave and go drive around for half an hour with the guy in your car, you know? And that yeah, that varies from state to state, too, in terms of, you know, is it a parking lot test where you have to, you know, first parallel park, then go through these cones, then do this, then do that? Or is it a real test where you have to go out on the street?
Yeah, right. And they probably should do that. And then, of course, that gets into, well, if they thought it was so important that you knew exactly how many car lengths you should be in what kind of conditions or whatever, then why don't they retest you on that every now and then, especially with update? I don't get anything in the mail that says, hey, we've changed the laws. We've decided it should be 2 car lengths and not 3 car lengths, or 35 seconds and not 25 seconds. Whatever. Well, if they think that's important, then why don't they?
Well, and there has been a lot of discussion about that, especially with aging drivers, but it seems like it makes sense to apply it across the board, where, you know, they don't have people repeat the tests. And it seems like, well, you know, maybe you should have to reprove yourself every few years that says, you know, you're still a good driver. I don't know. Or maybe you go the other way and say, yeah, you screw this driver's licensing thing entirely. You know, unless you hit somebody, you're fine.
Yeah. You kind of got to go one or the other. Either you're going to say knowing this stuff is important and then you retest it. Or I think you have to say, you know, once you're a driver, you're a driver. And so we shouldn't put so much emphasis on this stuff. I don't know. It just seems rather odd, the mix of things that you get. But it's so variable from state to state, too. And everybody just drives into different states. So yeah, it's not like when you pass the state, you are told, wait a minute, hold on, you're coming into Virginia, you got to know how many car lengths. There's nothing like that. So I don't know.
Right.
Seems arbitrary.
So I got you off topic. I apologize. You were about to mention the driver's license requirements, I guess, air travel.
Oh yeah. And that is, you know, just was the topic anyway, but, so air travel, I was just surprised because I was told the other day, just recently, that Virginia has, had an issue that a couple of other states have had where they've decided that the driver's license isn't going to be sufficient as your, identifying, you know, piece of information for going through the airport security in Virginia airports anymore. And this just changed in, I guess, end of October. And I just flew in October and didn't have this problem. So it's very, very recent. I haven't encountered it yet, but this is apparently the change in the law. So now I'm going to have my passport or government ID or something like that. And my kids won't be able to use things like a driver's license to get on a plane. And I guess the advantage of that is, well, you know, thank goodness I can't have a kid go off to another country without my knowledge. Whew. But, it's, to me, that's a little odd that suddenly the driver's license isn't enough. And I'm wondering if you have experienced that or you've heard that in other states or have heard anybody talking about it.
I heard, I thought I saw something that something similar was actually going to be happening in my state, in Washington state as well. But I hadn't dug into it at that time. And I'm also, you know, trying to Google around as we're talking about it right now to just get any confirmation of it. And I haven't really been able to find anything, on this. Let's see. I'm wondering, I mean, cause
it might be recent from the latest local elections. Cause I haven't been able to, I haven't confirmed it either. This is all kind of rumor mill almost, but I know that's been talked about before, that does the driver's license count? Why should it count? Why shouldn't it count? And that's more complicated than we need to get into necessarily, but
okay, so
doesn't it all seem rather unfitting that you
so you
have to know how many yards you can park from a fire hydrant?
So here we go. I have something on this from an article published this September 21st. The article is, on, Fly Girl, which is part of Jezebel. So flygirl.jezebel.com from September 21st. If you're from one of these states and planning to fly in 2016, lol, sorry. Attention driver's license holders from New York, Louisiana, New Hampshire, Minnesota, and American Samoa, and now adding Alaska, Arizona, Idaho, Louisiana, Maine, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Virginia, and Washington.
Holy cow, that's a lot of states.
In 2016, the final phase of the Real ID Act, passed by Congress in 2005, based on recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, goes into effect. It defines real IDs as those that are obtained only with proof of U.S. citizenship. In the aforementioned states, driver's licenses do not require proof of citizenship and are therefore considered non-compliant with the Real ID, and thus they will no longer be acceptable forms of ID when boarding federally regulated commercial aircraft. And what they say is if you hold a license from one of those states, have been using it, your ID, you need to make changes. You'll have a 3-month forgiveness period. This takes into effect at the beginning of 2016. So I guess you really have till April. But from January, February, and March, you'll get a stern warning from TSA if you try to go. And then acceptable IDs will be passports, passport cards, U.S. military ID, enhanced driver's license, permanent resident cards, and DHS trusted traveler cards like Global Entry and Nexus. Basically, it's all about the fact that some states say you have to be an American citizen to get a driver's license, and some don't, which is, it's actually one of those odd things. Why would a driver's license require a citizenship proof? Because if you are here on a green card and otherwise are a legal immigrant but not yet a citizen, and you want to be able to drive your car, you still need a driver's license.
But, yeah. And you know, these people have already proven that they know that the safety belt is not just to keep you warm or keep your groceries down.
Right.
So, you know, I that just seems odd to me that there would be such a huge difference in standards from state to state or for purpose to purpose.
Well, and
that you could drive a car right next to somebody at high speeds, or on the other side, that you barely have to show that you're able to even read a sentence, you know, and then, you know, you can fly with this, or no, you're not even, this doesn't even count as your identity. That it just seems really odd to me that it's so different from state to state.
And this is one of the things that's, you know, we have a federal system, and driver's licenses are a state issue, and we do not have a required national ID. So, every state has different requirements for these. And it seems like the federal government has decided that they want more for air travel. Now, let's add to this, like, how much does it really get you anyway? The driver's license proves you are, well, to some degree, proves you are who you say you are. All of this stuff is forgeable, of course. But in terms of actual security the point of all this is to keep dangerous people off the plane, right? I mean, it's they're going to compare you against their no-fly list. And presumably the no-fly list, you know, has non-citizens as well as citizens. So why does this make a difference? It really seems kind of silly to me.
Is there a preponderance of people, like a whole demographic, not getting their license because of unfair reasons? Is that what's going on? Is that what's making people object to that?
To which?
Well, what caused this to be a problem in the first place? Is it because I'm guessing that there was maybe electoral problems or right to vote or
what you mean in terms of why some states
allow the license? Yeah.
Oh, don't allow the license if you're not a citizen, you mean?
Or why there's a problem using the license as your form of identification? Is that because is there a demographic issue so that people can't get their license?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know that it really makes a lot of sense here. It sounds like this real ID thing after 9/11 basically defined a certain standard for what should be an acceptable ID that they want. It's guarding against more easily forgeable stuff, I guess. So they decided one of those requirements is that they only wanted identification that you could get along with proof of citizenship. So I don't know why citizenship matters to identity in these cases, but they figure if you're not an American citizen boarding an airplane, you should be using your passport anyway. And so American citizens flying should have an ID that they had to require their had to prove their citizenship for.
I don't know, but it takes 6 weeks to get a passport at least. I don't know. I could see that being a problem. Excluding people from.
I can see it causing a lot of issues. I mean, even as it is, by the way, there are people who don't have driver's licenses, you know, that are proper citizens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But what if you're blind? It doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to fly.
Yes. And most states offer alternative IDs, of course. But it seems like it just seems like a lot of this TSA stuff that was put into position after 9/11, it's more things that are, you know, ooh, look, we're doing all this security stuff, as opposed to things that actually make a difference. One of the other things is even TSA, points out. So I just went to a page on the TSA website that was linked to from that article I mentioned earlier, that all of this may be a little rigmarole anyway, because actually you don't need an ID to fly at all.
Really?
At all. They ask you now if, first of all, so I'm looking at the actual TSA's website at tsa.gov, a blog post they posted back in 2013, because, you know, hey, people lose their wallets. People lose their wallets at the airport. Sometimes they forget their IDs. So first of all, one thing, if you're under 18, you don't need an ID, period, of any sort. If you are over 18, if you go to the document checker and tell them you don't have their ID, then you will be hassled. You know, you will have to go through an additional process. But then they're going to ask you some questions, apparently from publicly available databases and some other things, basically to try to get enough information to confirm your identity. Now, if they can't confirm your identity by checking other things,
Your dental records, or what do they check?
Well, they're not specific on this web page, and of course they're not going to be, but like, I could imagine, for instance, I don't have my ID, but I have my credit cards that have my name on them. And then they ask, well, what's your home address? And they can probably cross-reference that with other databases they have. And so so they know your name, and they're going to ask your home address. Maybe they'll ask your birthday. Maybe they'll ask your social security number. Because, you know, look, it's the federal government. They've got all kinds of records on you.
Yeah. So all the things that they would do at the DMV,
you know, what
don't want to do with everyone.
Right. I mean, hell, they've got your taxes. What, you know, how much did you pay in taxes last year? You know,
maybe they know your emails from the last year.
Maybe. but in any case, so this is not a matter of if you don't have this, you can't fly. It's if you don't have this, you're going to have to go through a much more annoying process that takes time, and then eventually you'll be able to fly. Unless you're out of luck and you answer all the questions wrong and they don't believe you are who you say you are, in which case, if you're lucky, they just say you can't get on the plane, go away. And if you're unlucky, you end up in jail. You never know.
So not a great range of options. You know, in a future show, you guys should maybe think about what's going to happen to the driver's license when there are driverless cars.
Yes. But once they're ubiquitous, there won't be any such thing, because you'll be able to put your 3-year-old in the car and tell it to go to school, and you won't.
Thank goodness.
Anyway, it will be interesting to see what they do once this takes effect, because it's one thing to say this, but that's a pretty large list of states.
Yeah, that's more states than I thought it was. I thought it was just a couple people who were kind of waffling.
And so you can see a whole bunch of people going, what the hell is going on here? And yeah, lines backed up out the door while they try to do these extra checks on people, really upset people. I mean, it'll probably wash out just like everything else they've done with security. Like, you know, after a few weeks, people get used to it and then it's not a big deal anymore. But it's still like all of these things that, you know, there's not a lot of evidence it really makes a difference in terms of actual security. And it's just a hassle for everybody. So it's really annoying. Anyway, yeah. I think we've talked way longer than I ever thought we would on driver's licenses. let's take a break, and we'll be back in a minute to talk about the coverage of science on TV. Back after this. Yeah. Here we go. We're back. So, coverage of science and science issues on television and other media. You'd mentioned you have a physics background, as did my friend Chad, and as do I, although it's been a long time since I used it for anything, which I feel sad about. But and I know it can be frustrating sometimes watching the more mainstream the publication or TV thing that you're looking at, the more you sometimes want to slap your head around what's being said. But what are your thoughts on the coverage of science and science issues?
Well, I think I was thinking, I mean, certainly that's been frustrating, but I was kind of honing in more on, if you're going to have coverage on TV, what should it be like? And, you know, I've been watching, so Star Talk has been coming out on TV recently, and I love Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, he's been great for science, Bill Nye the Science Guy, all that.
Yep.
But I just wonder, you know, I'm worried about if you can possibly make a Dr. Oz type situation out of science that maybe dumbs it down too much. You know, I always get kind of concerned when, you know, they have sort of science days and physics days and stuff, and they have really cool, you know, physics demonstrations, and this is awesome. And I do a lot of those myself, so I get it, and I love that, and we have to get people interested. But then I sort of feel like in some ways it's sort of a lie, because if you're going to really get into hard science, you have to do a lot of work and math and just hard stuff that isn't as fun and, you know, look at this pendulum, just not as visually exciting all the time. And I just
you have to run the same experiment hundreds of thousands of times and then run math on it to see if you are statistically significantly different than no effect whatsoever, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's actually exciting to somebody who's in science. But, you know, if you're trying to get somebody interested in science, either because you want them to go into science or just because you know they're never going to be interested in science, but you need them to pay attention long enough to make a decision. You know, what is the right approach to that? Do you make it fun and interesting, or do you stick to the right concept? And so I think TV is kind of special in that way, because it hasn't really opened up to science much in the past, and it has the potential to go either direction. And
I think you've got a few different aspects of this.
Yeah.
One, you've sort of got the, how do you get kids interested in it who might actually end up being scientists eventually? And sort of, you know, and then also for kids who aren't ever going to be scientists, how do you still get across sort of the most important parts of what matters about science and why it's a valid way of thinking, and maybe even generalizing to the larger problem of, how do you think critically about problems?
Yeah, and we're not just talking to kids. I mean, I'm talking to Congress, which basically is talking to kids sometimes.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was going to get to the next thing is beyond the kids, the vast population of non-scientists, non-engineers, non-technical people who hear things. How do you present it in such a way that, you know, I mentioned the coverage before, like one of the things that, is always, challenging, is how do you present something that is fundamentally, the whole process of science is sort of asymptotically approaching the truth, at least you want it to be, but you're never 100% certain of anything, and the next piece of evidence could move it in another direction. So
that's a great way of putting it.
so you're always talking about what your best understanding is at the moment of what's going on. And depending on the situation, that understanding might be very, very, very good and very, very solid, or it may be still pretty speculative. But you still want to tell people about the cool, new, exciting result. But I get the feeling a lot of this coverage, and this ties into what was going to be our next topic on health recommendations and things like that, things are always presented as this is the new truth.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, this is what this last thing indicates that it might be, and you should know that because it's interesting and it's exciting, but there's still a significant chance it could be something else. But also differentiating between the times when we, you know, things are pretty damn solid.
And it's frustrating because the whole reason most of the time that things are presented as this is the truth is that it's too complicated to explain to anyone and nobody wants to listen to all the rigor that went into it.
Nobody wants to listen.
And yet if you don't go into that, then suddenly you get to this, you know, you're just presenting a truth that isn't really a truth.
Well, but at the same time, and all of this stuff confuses people, like, you know, if you get some... One single study showed that there might be an effect of this chemical on that slightly increases your chances of cancer over a 20-year time period. And then another study 6 years later, 10 years later says, oh, you know, that first one was wrong. That gives everybody the possibility. You know, everybody thinks at this point, well, ignore those health recommendations because they don't know what they're talking about anyway. They take that information and apply it to global warming or anti-vax stuff or anything else like that as if it's the same, and it's not. There's the amount of evidence and understanding is very different in those kinds of scenarios. And I think the way things are publicized to the non-technical world is very bad at differentiating those kinds of scenarios.
Yeah, I think they're not very good at understanding what the underlying non-technical issues are, because so much of it depends on what people even want to hear. I mean, look, there's all sorts of science that tells us we should never get in a car and drive, like we're just talking about. And yet, if we hear one little thing about, oh, you should, you know, have more resveratrol or whatever, then suddenly everybody's eating this or not eating that or, you know, whatever else it is, because it kind of matches with something that makes them feel good anyway. They want to do it. It's easy. They want to glom onto it. So, you know, this whole idea of, well, you know, I don't want to
there was a tweet,
climate change,
there,
like there, inconvenience, you know.
There was a tweet I saw just this last week, and who knows who tweeted it. It just saw it flash by. But, you know, there were a couple different studies out in the last few weeks. One was the one I mentioned before about bacon and red meat potentially having negative effects. There was another in a series of studies that say red wine may have good effects. And, you know, the public reaction to red wine was, oh, awesome. Red wine. The red wine's
red
good
wine
for you.
And
yay.
Let's drink red wine and eat dark chocolate.
Exactly. And meanwhile, the study goes out on, you know, red meat and bacon and such, and they're like, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. That's ridiculous.
Exactly. They're still going to eat eggs and bacon. So breakfast is going no matter what the studies say.
And you know, and the reality on both of these kinds of things, we're sort of merging our next topic in with this, so we'll just go with it. These kinds of studies on nutritional kinds of things, one of the things that has been more and more being talked about the last year or so is that a lot of these are one-off studies that have never been replicated, that aren't necessarily taking into all of the proper controls they should have to make these decisions. And when people are trying to replicate these nutritional studies, they're unable to. A lot of them are based on self-reporting dietary logs and things like that, that people are notoriously bad at keeping properly. So there are all kinds of reasons why, you know, these specifically these nutritional things don't have as solid a basis as you would want them to. And there's been a lot of press just in general, not just nutritional, but on all kinds of other fields. Psychology has been mentioned, but hard sciences as well, where Officially, if you read about the scientific method and the right way of doing things, replication is an important part of it. The incentives aren't always there for the replication. So oftentimes what happens is you get the one big study that shows an effect and, it's above the 95% confidence interval. So people are like, yay, it's real, blah, blah, blah. And then nobody ever goes back and replicates it.
And maybe they never got funding to replicate it. That's another huge factor in this, that sometimes the hot topic, the shiny object, gets all the funding. And then redoing a study that was already done that makes people feel happy
isn't
going to get funding.
No, absolutely not. And that's a problem because, even if you're looking, even assuming you've done everything right, and part of replication is trying to find out the things that they did wrong. But even if you did everything right, if you've got a result with a 95% confidence interval, there's still a 1 in 20 shot that it was not real. There are all of these kinds of effects out there, and it's very hard the way that these things are presented to the public. Like I said, there's no differentiation between, hey, there was this one study and it needs to have a lot of follow-up before you can draw any real conclusions from it versus, let's examine, all of the many, many decades of evidence behind, evolution or relativity or climate change or any of these things where things are pretty damn solid around that. Now, that doesn't mean, they're not details around the edges that aren't well determined. It also doesn't mean that you might not discover something that revolutionizes your understanding of any of those issues, but there's a certain level of confidence we have there that's not the same as the fly by night, the new exciting study. But the new exciting study is, of course, the new exciting study.
Right.
So everybody's going to be like, "Oh wow, look at that! Oh,
let's put our funding there." And exactly. Well, and there's only, and of course, I don't know how to solve that problem because there is only limited funding and attention and personnel and expertise. You can't put it all on everything.
No,
it's a little like a game of
There are also significant cultural changes that are required. There's also been a lot of stuff pointed out about various flaws in the peer review system the review isn't as it's a lot more buddy buddy sometimes than it should be based on who and what's going on and reputations and
shiny object it is depends on who's looking at the object.
Right. And who's looking at the object. And also every couple of years, someone does something where they put together something that's 100% complete nonsense and submit it to peer reviewed journals and it gets through. And it's
there used to be this site. I don't know if you ever were on it, but I think it was like a decade ago. There was a site that did, I think it was an MIT related group. And they made this site where you could just enter a couple of names and it would create a paper that you could submit to a conference, and it would make the paper so that it sounded good enough to get by to accept you into a conference proceedings. And so, we had fun with that because, I had like papers that I wrote with, various people between Albert Einstein or Pamela Anderson or, whoever you want to peg. That kind of just showed that what was being asked for in terms of rigor wasn't, that had changed. You just had to fill in a few blanks.
I think there are a few cultural things, and some of them have already started to change from what I'm seeing. One is sort of breaking down these highly exclusive journals that, you have to be at an institution and pay lots of money to even see in the first place, that are behind paywalls and stuff, and having more stuff that's just posted publicly for anybody to get at and to encourage the back and forth and open criticism. It's just on the same kind of notion as open source software. The more eyes you have on something, the more possibility that someone will find the flaw. Also, you know, as a cultural thing, there's also the, you know, maybe you don't get into the big prestigious journal until you have a replication. You need two independent teams working separately before you can publish a damn thing.
Yeah, if they both get funding. No, I mean, that's
right.
The problem. What if can you do that threshold with things that aren't as exciting?
No,
if you don't have funding for two different projects.
Well, then there's the whole issue of how you get funding for all of these things and is there enough of it and blah, 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 which is a whole separate issue.
Yeah. we got like 10 different topics on this one thing.
But yeah, in terms of the media in general, getting back to the original topic before we wrap it up, I think the biggest problems with media coverage of science are chasing the shiny new thing, not understanding the limits of whatever it is they're reporting on properly. So, and that's on both extremes, the extremely tentative thing and the extremely certain thing. And also the false balance problem that occurs in a lot of different areas where, you know, you shouldn't give equal time to quote unquote both sides of the issue if it's something that is 99.9% settled. You don't bring on the one guy to talk about how the Earth is a sphere and the other guy to talk about how it's flat and let them argue their positions and give them equal time.
Yeah, if anything, you should have, you know, one person for one side and 99 people for the other one.
Yeah, I mean, or you know, if you want to bring on the person who's the one in a thousand scientists who thinks something else than others, then you give the person who's representing the consensus view almost all of the time, and then you say, oh yeah, and there are a few crackpots who don't agree, but they don't know what they're talking about. And then you move on.
But you know what? The more insidious of all those, though, those are the three main problems with science coverage. But the more insidious one is just not covering at all.
That's true. There's a lot that's not covered at all. And it's certainly, you know, you do still want to communicate the excitement of it and the wonder of finding out about the universe and what's going on and how things work and all of this kind of stuff, because you do want people to get interested and excited about this. And like I said, there's the more general problem too that I think is missing in a lot of places, which is simply the teaching of critical thinking and being able to take whatever problem it is, whether it's politics, whether it's science, whether it's whatever, and sort of, let's not worry about the dispensed truth from on high. Let's worry about the process of how you take in information and critically evaluate it and figure out what things you should believe, what things you should ignore, what things are uncertain and need more investigation, and try to get people to understand that. Because, you know, and a lot of people just want the easy way out to, okay, just tell me the answer.
Yeah, and I think people often come into whatever it is that they're watching because they just want to be reassured about the answer that they've already come to.
Yes, that's also very true. Okay, let's take a break. And we sort of covered the health recommendations a bit as well. The general question you gave, though, was when should you follow all of these health recommendations and when should you just wait? And I'd say for the most part, the answer right now is most of the time you're not going to change what you do anyway. And so just wait is probably a good answer.
I agree with that.
you have to look at all of the preponderance of the evidence and decide, how much of a major change you're going to make. Having said that, I mean, you know, look, it seems like there's a lot of good evidence that, sugar is bad for you. Okay. Did any of us not know that?
I think combining mastery of the obvious and the laws of inertia makes some sense here.
You know, lots and lots of red meat. Is that bad for you? Did anybody not know that? You know,
or anything that lasts long enough to be on the shelf without any refrigeration for a long time, you know, might taste good, probably not good for you. You know, it's a, but maybe who cares?
Well, and but, you know, with most of these things, the right answer is use common sense and moderation. The problem is that as a society, at least in the U.S. right now, these days, that's kind of out the window, because for the most part, you know, you want what's quick, what's easy, what tastes good. You want it all the time. I mean, I'm just as guilty as anybody else by that. Like, you know, if I've got a bag of chips here that I can just open up and eat, versus I'm going to have to think of something more complicated and put something together and make, you know, I'm going to eat the chips.
The next thing could be that stress is the most important thing. And Chad just sent me something the other day that was talking about how for some types of people, the willpower that you use to not eat something,
yes,
or not do something can actually, for some people, negatively affect their immune system, you know, and other functions in their body.
I saw something along those lines as well. And actually the one thing you just brought up, and I know we're wrapping up this topic, but I think is very important, is the for some people. Another right. thing that I think is being more and more clear, the more we end up knowing about anything health related, but certainly including nutrition, is that the variation between individuals is huge. You know, and there is probably not a single right answer that says this is the right diet that everybody should have, or this is the right balance between this and that, or, you know, or even, you know, when taking medicines or anything like that, that this is the right medicine for everybody for this condition. What we're finding more and more is that there's a huge range of variation between individuals and how they react to medicines, foods, everything else. And we're going to have to get a lot more sophisticated in our analysis of this over time, because it may very well be that, you know, the right thing for you would be completely wrong for me. And vice versa.
It's funny that we, you know, that's so obvious in every other part of life. And why haven't we been thinking that way with this stuff? I mean, we don't apply the same laws or anything else for everybody.
And
why don't we do that for nutrition?
and a lot of this may be genetic. A lot of it may be epigenetic, whatever. And if you have to project out, you know, 50 plus years, you know, I think we're going to get to the point where we're a lot more sophisticated and people will be able to give you, you know, they'll do a DNA test on you or whatever. And the information that comes out of that will affect the recommendations for all of these things.
And you'll say, I just hope that I am okay with bacon.
There you go. Or they'll be like, look, you know, you can have the bacon, but yes, it will increase the risk of a heart attack or cancer or whatever by such and such percent over your lifetime.
They'll say, but don't worry about it, because that'll increase your blood pressure.
Right. But then you have, just like we were talking about with cars, you will decide whether or not that risk is worth it for you. Because, yes, yeah, you are safer never riding in a car. But there are benefits from riding in a car, too. And we do that cost-benefit trade-off every day that says, you know, yes, it is worth the 1 in 1,000 chance I will die in a car this year for me to get around.
Yeah, it's funny, just I know we're wrapping up here, but I just saw a comedian the other day who was saying that he was in a Shark Tank thing where the sharks were circling around, and it just, you know, scared the shit out of him. And he was the guy afterwards that was hosting this Shark Tank experience was saying, oh, okay, you want to go swimming or surfing now? And he said, no, are you kidding me? I'm scared to death now. I never want to go swimming again. He said, you're way more likely to get killed by your toaster. And he said, well, thanks. Now I'm afraid of toast.
Well, there you go. Okay, let's take a break. Let's skip the third segment since we sort of combined them, and we'll jump straight to a lightning round, and we'll do like a 15-minute lightning round, and then we'll wrap up the show. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we are back. So we're going to do a lightning round. So I'm going to get a timer set up here. And we're going to do two-minute segments. And just we'll alternate, throw out whatever topic you want. And we'll chat about it for 2 minutes. And then we'll move on to the next one. So I'm going to let you start. You have something in mind?
Well, I guess I did have something that was sort of from earlier tonight that I was kind of curious, like why we use brand names for some things and not for other things. You know, why we say Scotch tape, not all of us do, but some of us do. But when then we say masking tape and then we say duct tape and, you know, it just I was just curious, like what makes something take on as a brand name? Or as a product.
So the Kleenexes and Googles of the world and things like that. You know, I think most of the time it really is that simple. It's like, did a single company get a big head start on the competition at some point in time so that people started using it generically before, you know, all the alternatives came out? And I'm sure that's regional, too. Like, one of the examples that I've seen occasionally is that in a large part of the country, and I couldn't even believe this before I saw things on this, but all sodas are called Coke.
You know? Oh, right. Yeah.
And
I have Coke.
And you know, but the rest of the country, that's not true. And so there's a lot of inertia related to it, too. But, you know,
Pennsylvania's like that.
We have Xeroxing, we have Kleenex, people Google things, whether or not they're actually using Google, although most people use Google, et cetera. You mentioned, duct tape, like the original actually wasn't the brand name. It's DUCT for ducts. It's tape used on ducts.
Actually, the original is duck. It's DUCK.
No, there is a duck, but it came later.
That's not what I heard. I thought that so Johnson & Johnson created the first duct tape as we know it, but it was actually called duct tape because it was emulating the outer layer of a duck.
Nah, let's see. The first, there's some truth to that. you're right. The first material called duct tape was long strips of plain cotton duck cloth used in making shoes stronger. Okay, you're right. reading off the Wikipedia page. And then there is an actual brand that is duck tape.
That's like a whole other dimension of branding and stuff, because it's a brand off of an original idea that also applied to something that sounds similar. So I wonder if that had anything to do with the longevity of duct tape.
I don't know. Anyway, our 2 minutes are up.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it's just if one gets going first, and there's no real competition for a new concept, it sort of wins out and gets the name. But as we know, legally, they have to fight against that, because if the name does become a generic term, they can often lose their trademark on it.
Mm. Yeah.
So anyway, my turn. Let's see here. Okay, as I tend to do, I've been reported on when I've watched movies and things like that. And this time around, I must say, since I've been working from home, there have been more of these, because I tend to have things on in the background while I work, whether they're TV shows or movies or whatever, and I'm usually not paying 100% attention to them, but they sort of count. So I watched the movie Princess and the Frog, an animated movie from a few years back. I forget, is it Disney? I think it might
be. Oh, yeah, it was a Disney movie. It was a Disney movie. I remember that.
I was forgetting if it was Disney or one of their competitors. But anyway, it was an okay little movie. Nothing like extraordinary. I just confirmed it's Disney. It came out in 2009. This woman who grows up in New Orleans. She wants to start a restaurant. There's of course a prince who comes to town, and he gets turned into a frog, and blah blah blah, hijinks ensue. It was a fun little movie, but you know, it's not, you know, one that I'm gonna remember, especially as, oh my God, remember that movie? I want to make sure I see it again over and over again. There are very few movies that come to that on me, but this is one that's not super memorable, but it was an enjoyable, 97 minutes. I don't regret watching it. It was fun. And I mean, it's a kid's movie. My son and daughter had both watched it a number of times, but I had seen bits and pieces of it, but had never watched the whole thing straight through. So I did. It was fun.
I would concur with you on that. I thought it was a cute movie, but I didn't remember it until you mentioned it.
There you go. Okay, your turn again.
Okay, let's see. I guess I had been thinking about, this might be more than a lightning round, but just to throw out there, I was thinking about languages and whether we're moving towards like a super language for everyone, or whether we're going to go more in the direction of maintaining separate languages.
That's a tough one. I think that, you know, depends on short term versus long term. I think, you know, if you look, I've seen various things that talk about the number of actively spoken languages on the planet, and it's plummeting. There are all kinds of small languages that go extinct every year because the last people who speak them die off. And so I think the trend is definitely right now towards less languages, but we're nowhere close to switching to the one world global language. We sort of have, I mean, English is almost a lingua franca for some types of international communications. But that may be a temporary thing. I mean, they're more native Chinese speakers. So I see the number of languages reducing, but I don't see us being at one world language in the next 1,000 years. But 10,000, sure, maybe.
It'd be interesting to see if there's any kind of per capita studies of per this many people and this kind of density. Is there a conservation law for languages?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, I think part of the thing is the question of, you know, we've had a lot of trends recently towards globalization and increased communication and increased sharing of culture and blah, blah, blah. But do those trends continue, or do we start getting more isolated areas again? Like, for the last 100 years, the world has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller in that, I mean, now you can pick up your phone right now and make a call to almost any part of the world. You don't even have to go through an operator. You know, you can dial, you know, any country in the world almost and get somebody on the other end. And you can have those conversations. And even without doing that, you can email them. You can go back and forth. You can do all this stuff. You've got automatic online translation to help, even though it still kind of sucks, to help with communication. You've got, airplane travel. You've got all kinds of things. Does that trend continue, or does it start getting harder to get places? Do we start breaking, increasing the barriers so that certain countries sort of start walling themselves off from the world and things like that?
The fact that you have to commute 2 hours to work, I mean, nobody would ever have expected that before we could commute 2 hours to work.
Well, yeah. I mean, that 2 hours is 25 miles. If you go back 100 years, the idea of going 25 miles and back in a single day on a routine basis would be insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe not 100 years, because that's after the development of the car, but 150 years.
Not that long ago.
Yeah, and I mean, and if we're talking about the development of languages, we're talking over many hundreds of years. We're not talking about anything that's going to happen in our lifetimes. We're talking about hundreds or thousands of years to see how it develops. I think there's definitely a tendency towards, you know, I mean, even when you have one language, you have dialects develop and you have regionalisms develop and you have things like that. But those rely on your ties to your immediate neighbors being a lot stronger than your ties to the more general culture. And the more mass media we have and the more sharing we have, the less that's true. I think even... Although there's still huge differences, like if you travel around the United States, it's really different, you know, being in Louisiana than it is being in Minnesota. But those differences are less than they were, you know, 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 150 years ago. You know, because there's a lot that's common. You're watching the same national TV shows. You've got the same national chains. You've got the same, you know, this and that and this and that. And so those regional differences start getting papered over. And that the same is true of language at a larger scale globally. So I don't know. Okay. Is it my turn again?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Okay. I don't want to do all movies here because I did finish a few, like I said, because I've been staying home so damn much. But I do want to mention the election stuff and some of what's been going on there since it's our perennial topic. We had another Republican debate last night, Tuesday night, Wednesday, whatever. The fact I use UTC makes everything confusing. Anyway, we had another Republican debate, and I don't think a lot is going to change specifically as a result of that. First of all, I haven't seen the final ratings for it yet, but I suspect less people have watched it than the previous ones. It's on a channel that less people get, the little bit less publicity. Plus, we had another one only a couple weeks ago, and I think people are getting a little tired of them. And there were no real breakout moments as there were. Trump and Carson got a little less attention. It got very wonky on some of the economic stuff, and people started diving into details of policy, which on the one hand is, oh, wow, it's an actual substantive debate on the other on something. On the other hand, it's, oh, that's actually kind of boring. Carson got a pass on a lot of what he was talking on all the biographical stuff. He got one question on it, but nobody really dug in or questioned him much on it. So we'll see. I think
there seems to be a lot of apologizing going on for any kind of digging in that is happening, which is sort of strange.
Yeah, I think the general trend over the next couple weeks, and I tweeted this a little bit, is probably going to be a continuation of where we were, which is Trump and Carson down a little bit, or flat or down a little bit. Rubio and Cruz seem to be gaining a little bit. Bush has been on a continually downward trend, and I don't think he did anything in the debate to change that. And that's roughly where we are. And we've still got a ways to go, but it's looking like, absent a big change, we've got Trump, Carson, Rubio, and Cruz on the Republican side to deal with, and Clinton's Clinton on the Democratic side. So that's it, I guess, for election 2016 this time. Your turn. Do you got more?
Well, I guess sticking actually with the election 2016, which it's not even 2016 yet, but
yep.
Sticking with that theme, I just heard somebody today say, wouldn't it be fun if we had the people hosting the debates being people like Rush Limbaugh and Hannity or something? And I was thinking, oh my gosh, that'd be terrible. But then I thought, well, that actually could be entertaining.
Yeah, that has been brought up in the last couple of weeks, where the Republicans specifically, they want friendly questioners. They want questioners who are Republican. And I'm not sure, like, the Hannity and Limbaughs would be as friendly as they think they would be, necessarily.
I don't think they would. I don't think they would be friendly.
I think they would be hostile from the other side, perhaps. But, you know, I think you've got it right. I think from the point of view of how much would you really learn, I'm not sure you'd learn that much more, but I think it would definitely be entertaining.
I think it would be entertaining. It would be a little bit like WWE, but, you know, election style.
There you go. Okay, let's see. Should I do... you know, we're at about 15 minutes. Why don't we wrap it there? As usual, I've got a few other things. Oh, yeah. Actually, one more. I just want to ask you. What are your thoughts on the whole thing about the Starbucks cups?
Is this the boycotting the Christmas cups, or which one are we talking about here?
Yeah, basically. So what's going on is that every year, around this time of year, Starbucks changes their cups. They're normally white and green. They make them red and green. And every year is a slightly different design. They've had snowflakes, they've had snowmen, they've had all kinds of other things. But this year, it's a plain red cup with the green Starbucks logo on it, and that's all. And a lot of the sort of the fundamentalist Christian groups have started to get up in arms about how this is Starbucks taking the Christmas out of Christmas because there's nothing about Christmas on this cup because it's just red. And so they're trying to get people to boycott Starbucks and do other things along those lines.
I guess my feeling would be there is nothing at all related between Starbucks and Christmas or Starbucks and religion or any of those topics. So I don't even see why it's an issue. As far as I'm concerned, Starbucks is a company, and if they choose to lose money to a certain group, they can do that. So I guess people could do that, but I think it's overreacting. I mean, there are Christmas decorations in, you know, Walmarts at Halloween. So I don't see how having a red cup for your coffee is really doing anything crazy. Well, but they can do that if they want to.
The interesting thing here to me is it's red and green. That's pretty Christmassy. If you look at the store more generally, they've got holiday decorations up of various sorts. They've got snowflakes. They've got the whole thing. Now, of course, it's, as I said, it's holiday decorations. They're seasonal decorations. They're not specifically Christmas decorations in the religious sense of the word. And that's what's sort of upsetting people. But of course, in terms of Starbucks specifically, that's always been the case.
They're trying to please the maximum number of people by roasting their coffee a certain way and selling whatever coffee is the most number of people will buy. So to me, it makes corporate sense that they would try to design their cups to both welcome and not offend as many people as possible. And I think that the holiday situation is so difficult that they just figured, let's just try to be low key and yet Christmassy at the same time. So if anything, they're suffering from a little bit of wishy-washiness on that front. But it's hard to identify anything that is offensive.
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, you get people, you know, every year we hear about this war on Christmas and, you know, people railing against people saying happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas or whatever. But, you know, if you are anything other than a Christian, it's not like you can avoid Christmas in America.
Yeah, you're being drowned by Christmas.
If you're Jewish, if you're an atheist, if you're Muslim, if you're Hindu, if you're anything else, you know, yes, you're drowned by Christmas. It's everywhere. It's unavoidable. It's barely after Halloween, and we're already talking about this stuff. So for 2 months, you get nothing but Christmas. And, you know, I always look at this in terms of, you know, hey, if somebody says Merry Christmas and you are not Christian, yeah, you take it graciously. But if somebody says happy holidays, okay, that's cool too. I mean, like, why would you worry about, and if you know someone is of a particular faith and celebrate some other holiday, then of course the polite thing to do is to, you know, wish them a good their holiday, whatever the holiday is. It seems like the happy holidays construction, yes, it's inclusive. It adds all these people. And of course, that's why people are defensive about it. They're like, they don't want to be inclusive. They want, you know, their holiday, and they want everybody to believe that. But, you know, that's not the world or the country we live in at this point.
So the red cup is essentially the happy holidays in visual form with coffee in it.
Yes. And apparently it was less of that when it had a snowflake on it. But I don't see why particularly, because it's not like a snowflake is... It's
Christmas oriented. What if you're in Hawaii? Then you don't have snowflakes with Christmas.
I mean, it's not like Starbucks never made a Christmas cup with like a manger scene on it. You know, it's snowmen and snowflakes and, you know, happy winter things. And
if they did, they'd have to have a cup for every type of possible theme.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah. I think that's a show. Thank you very much for joining us, Amber. I had fun. This was good.
Oh, thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Great. And hopefully we'll do it again some other time. In the meantime, as everybody knows, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts on any of this stuff, the best place to find us right now is on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. We're Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook. And you can put your comments there and we'll reply back to you either there or on a future show. We'd love to hear from you. Of course. Tell your friends all about the show, too. We'd love to have more listeners. Have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.